When is a bank not a bank? And how difficult is it to change your bank when you know you really want to break up with it? This week, we explore why the Banking Royal Commission has changed the way the banks brand themselves. And Guns and Collingwood Football Club. Is there a link? We reckon there is, but the link is explained by a psychological theory that we can all relate to. That, women in STEM, the Middle East, vegan burgers and the AFLW are all up for consideration. So if you're interested in marketing, culture and the world of business, you should listen to this. So we've got a lot of these things coming up today, and to help me unpick all of those elements of marketing, culture and the world of business, I've got two very intelligent humans sitting here in my office / studio. I have Luca Cella. Luca is the manager of international at RMIT, but a former MBA marketing student here at Deakin Uni. Welcome, Luca.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for the compliment as well.
No worries. And Jeff Rotman. Jeff is a lecturer here at Deakin University in marketing, and Jeff sits on the other side of me, as opposed to Ginny, who was sitting on the right of me. Jeff sits on the left of me. Welcome today, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. So let's get straight into it. I think one of the things that I found really interesting in the last couple of weeks about marketing, I guess, is the way that the banks have responded to the Royal Commission. And really interesting when I look at the way that banks are branding themselves now, they kind of have this whole idea now that they're not a bank, that they're trying to not be banks, when in fact a couple of years ago there was a similar campaign from NAB, and I know that you kind of used, do you use the NAB kind of case study in your classes, Jeff?
Yeah, so I think you're talking about the NAB breakup campaign.
Oh, yeah, that's the one, yeah.
Yeah, and they tried to disassociate themselves, maybe not as a bank, but definitely from the other big three banks.
And yet it was NAB who seemed to have had, you know, one of the worst kind of raps in the Royal Commission.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's really interesting because a lot of the time in the rhetoric you hear people saying, you know, if you don't like your bank, just leave it. But it's actually quite hard to leave your bank, isn't it, Luca?
It is incredibly hard, Paul. I'm with Commonwealth, if I may say so. And it is the only reason why I'm not leaving them is that I've got a lot of automatic payments, and that if I was to change, I would have to change all these automatic payments. And that's really the only reason why I'm still sticking with them. Yeah. I'm not happy with their services. I'm not happy with their phone calls, nor their customer service.
I reckon that banks rely a huge amount on the brand, and that's why the big four kind of work, but also I guess on inertia. And you know that they wouldn't say that, they always kind of say it's about the customer and everything, but you know, if you have the chair of the ACCC and the prime minister, or the former prime minister Malcolm Turnbull, saying if you don't like your bank, leave it, and even like I remember in the last year or so they kind of reduced the fees that you need to pay to change your bank, and yet people don't change banks.
This kind of goes up to this question of, you know, competition, and then, right, and there's this idea of competition in air quotes and then real competition. We've had a similar conversation when we talked about mobile carriers.
Oh, yeah,
as
that's
well.
Right. Yeah.
Right? And it's, you know, if one mobile carrier screws you over,
it's as bad as all,
it is all the other. What are you going to do? You're going to, you know, go in and cancel and then find another one just to get the same sort of treatment. And I think the same thing is with banks, right? There's, you know, there's really only, you have your big four, and if you want to leave one, it's a whole pain, and then you go to another bank that's not going to do much better. And so there's not, you know, there's no incentive for these companies to really change.
I think too, one of the things that I find really interesting is the new Bank West kind of branding campaign, and we'll just have a little listen to it now.
This is a bank ad. So it starts with someone looking thoughtfully out a window,
or walking down a busy city street among the people. Then showing you meaningless numbers and indecipherable jargon that makes things seem complicated. Now, nod like you understand. Good. We'll show you how we're with you every step of the way. Like one big happy family. We understand real budgie smuggling Australians.
Hardworking Australians.
Especially florists.
Now at the end of the ad, it's time for the big banky musical climax, where we show how we go above and beyond the rest.
Haven't we had enough of all this BS?
And by BS, I mean bank stuff. So, at Bank West, it's bankless from now on. Less jargon, less about us, less bank stuff.
And so what I find really interesting about that one is that they're actually saying that they're not a bank, that that you bank less with Bank West, when in fact Bank West is really just a subsidiary of the Commonwealth Bank. So you really, as you were saying before, Jeff, you're really getting the same service, but there's these sub-brands. Actually, now that I think about it, having not even, you know, without even giving you guys any kind of warning about this, but I think about that with a whole bunch of kind of international corporate brands, you know, that in reality we like to think that we're buying a craft beer, for example, but you know, we're probably buying something from either Asahi or, I don't know, the other brand, the Lion Nathan kind of branding umbrella. It's the same with banks.
That's right. I mean, one of my favorite examples of this kind of mass branding is with Unilever and Dove, and then Lynx or Axe, depending on, right? So Dove selling, you know, self-esteem to women, and then they have this other marketing campaign that's, you know, just overly sexualizing. Yeah. And they're the same, you know, parent company and the same parent brand.
What I like about this ad, Paul, is that it connects with you on a personal level, and that's something that the four big banks don't actually do. Whether that is true or not, I don't know. You don't care. But, you know, I see my bank as this big, you know, corporation that just takes my money, pretty much. Whereas this one tries to a different angle, which I quite like. Whether they do it or not, that's, again, another story.
Well, I think that's one of the things about, understanding the psychology of marketing as well, is this idea that you distance yourself. You say, that wouldn't happen to me. And you were kind of talking about that, Jeff, this idea that you say, if it happened to me, I'd change banks.
That's right. Yeah, so this, I mean, taps into what's called like the fundamental attribution error, which is this idea that when something happens, you know, to you, you might want to blame like external circumstances. It wasn't necessarily me, but when something happens to other people, you blame it on, you know, like themselves. So the typical example is, you know, if you trip, it's because like the floor was uneven or something, or slippery. If someone else trips, it's because they're clumsy,
uncoordinated.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, yeah, when you see, you know, people, you know, get into these situations, you think, oh, well, it's because they're irresponsible. Like you said, that would never happen to me. And,
I see that in so many contexts because of the work that I kind of do in consumer protection and consumer well-being, is that you go into these places, you go into the telecommunications companies, you go into the banks, you go into even into the regulators, and they say, why, and this is a very generic kind of thing, but why are people so dumb? Why do they get themselves into that difficulty? And they say, I would never do that. And yet, you know, there are so many examples where people do. And I think fundamental attribution error is a really good way to kind of think about it, is to say, yeah, it's easy to attribute problems to other people, but if you actually say, maybe I'm pretty flawed as well, it kind of, your entire world collapses around you, because you go, everything that I believed about me being a good person operating the world starts falling down.
And I think you can see across a lot of industries, and one that I can think of is the insurance industry. That it's very easy to sign up, but incredibly difficult to get out.
It's like gyms.
So, exactly. So, yeah, it's not that easy to just change.
And maybe does that apply, Jeff, to gyms as well, that fundamental attribution error? Like you kind of believe, or is there another theory that would help to explain that, that you believe that you're going to be going to the gym regularly, but other people who go to the gym and don't go, they're the ones who are lazy? I mean, it sounds very similar.
Yeah, it taps into a bit of an optimism bias as well, right? So there's, you know, everyone, if you ask 100 people if they're above average, all 100 of them will say yes, and on any sort of attribute.
Yes.
But the other piece about, you know, this kind of the switching and why people kind of get into these messes is interesting in that, right, there's just so much, especially when it comes to things like banks or insurance or healthcare. There's a lot of information, and people lack expertise, and there's just too much. There's too much information and not enough time for, I think, a lot of people. And so people just, in those situations, will just default to the status quo.
Yeah. Right? And it's easy to default to the status quo because you don't have to think too much.
Exactly.
A lot of people would like to think that they think about all of their choices, but actually most people, I always kind of think about it as most people are like Labradors. They prefer to just have a bit of a snooze in a kind of metaphorical way.
And also in a real way.
In a real way, exactly. And your breakfast is, you're feeling a bit tired after a big breakfast, eh? I do think it's really interesting with banks trying to kind of brand themselves again as good corporate citizens, and yet, you know, the reality is, can a bank be a good corporate citizen? Jeff, what do you reckon?
There's no reason they couldn't be.
Mm.
And
they're massive corporations.
Corporations, and they do provide a really essential service across, you know, the world. And there's no reason that they couldn't be, you know, good. Actually, one of my bank back in Canada, I actually thought it was generally pretty good. They positioned themselves on, you know, trying to be as easy and as comfortable as possible. And one time they, you know, said a situation, they basically pushed an idea or something on me, and I felt uneasy, but I accepted it. And then I went back the next day and said, you know what? This was pushed on me, and they let me out of the contract.
So like a product or something?
It was like an investment sort of thing. And, you know, there's no reason that that they can't be, you know, make a profit plus treat people properly. And I think that that's across the board of a lot of businesses. I think one of the things that we should move towards as a society is kind of this constant, right? You can be profit-seeking, but treat people like people in the same way that you would treat, you know, friends, right? You don't necessarily, if someone borrows something or from you, you should give it back. And
you, what? I've got so many delightful tools. Oh, you meant to give them back, are you? Is that,
exactly.
Oh, right. Oh, no wonder I have no friends. Right. But I think the difficulty, and this is, you know, the work that I've done in banks and things like that, one of the difficulties is that there are really good people within those organisations at an individual level, but corporations are these behemoths, these huge organisations where an individual can make a difference, but you actually have to have a culture that supports people doing the right thing. I think one of the interesting banks that I've seen recently that is going out of its way to brand itself to being, and maybe targeting millennials and targeting people who have a conscious kind of view of the world, is Bank Australia, which is a former, I'm trying to remember now, former building society, I think, or maybe a credit union, I'm not sure, but it's branding themselves as a bank. They've also branded themselves as Bank Australia. So it even sounds like this kind of international, or this national kind of corporation. But if you look at a lot of the campaigns, it's very much about, we don't invest in organisations or businesses that use fossil fuels. You know, their advertising is all sunsets and sunrises and things like that. I do think it's a really interesting new market that they're saying, well, maybe, and I hate using the term, but, you know, maybe the younger people, the millennials, are the ones who are actually looking for a different way to kind of consume the world. What do you think, Luca? I mean, you work a lot with millennials.
I do. But look, Paul, I like that sort of approach. I like the personal approach, the sort of idea that the bank is, as you said, not that humongous place that just sucks your money, but instead, I like banks that are approachable. So that
sort and yet of, you stay with Commonwealth Bank.
That's right. That's right.
Really, and I mean, and that's not a criticism of you. Absolutely. It's the same of me and the same of everybody. Absolutely. It's really effortful to change banks, I think.
It is. And I'll tell you more, Paul. When my sister came over from Italy 4 years ago, the first thing she had to do was to set up a bank account. And guess what? I took her to the Commonwealth Bank. Because it was just easy for me then to transfer money across the bank accounts.
I think that's one of the things that banks rely on too, is that, you know, if you don't know where you're going to bank, you talk to somebody you trust.
Yeah,
I think there's a new campaign with Richard Ayoade from the United Kingdom. Richard Ayoade, who's a comedian, anyone who watched The IT Crowd would know him, or Travel Man or anything like that, with HSBC. And it actually mirrors a little bit of Travel Man. And so, again, the target market for Travel Man is kind of the younger audience. But what's interesting about the HSBC ad is that it finishes with, if you're banking at the bank of mum and dad, or dad and dad, or mum and mum. And so in a way, it's even highlighting this kind of new way of thinking about how you might see yourself and where you come from. So not as conservative, but HSBC as a brand in the United Kingdom has always been seen as a little bit like the Commonwealth Bank here in Australia, a very old-fashioned bank. So really interesting trying to target itself. I mean, I think we'll take a quick 180 degree right now and talk a little bit about similar but different this idea of, you know, trying to be moral in an organisation and trying to do the right thing. But anyone who's anyone would have noticed in the last couple of days and maybe the last couple of weeks, kind of on the back end, contributing to what's happened, the horror that happened in Christchurch in New Zealand, One Nation, and the documentary that from Al Jazeera that's been shown on the ABC, How to Sell a Massacre. I think one of the difficulties you suddenly have with One Nation now is that they already had a particular target market. In a way, the fact that they were seeking funding from the NRA in the United Kingdom for trying to change the gun laws in Australia. Scott Morrison's come out, said that they're going to put One Nation under Labor but not last on their How to Vote cards in the coming election. But what's really interesting, and I want to kind of come to you about this, Luca, is how my perception is that it actually might strengthen One Nation's base, because they're going to be saying, well, you know, these are the things that I believe in. And you have some background in the kind of marketing of guns. And you were talking about this whole idea that the people who join the gun community or buy guns actually become part of a really strong community.
Absolutely, Paul. So I like the example of ice cream versus guns. So first of all, I should say my background is I was the marketing manager at Beretta, one of the oldest firearms companies in the world. They've been making guns since the 1500s, so when firearms were first invented. But what I was going to say is when you buy an ice cream or a sandwich, you don't become part of the community, say the ice cream eater community. Whereas when you buy a gun, you become... Okay.
I'm part of the gelato community.
Cool. Well, but not everyone, Paul. Whereas when you buy a gun, you become part of the shooting community. So you'll see that a lot of people within the shooting community have fairly similar political ideas, have a fairly similar behavior. You become part of a large community, a community that thrives on disagreeing with others, on others hating them. And a lot of the narrative from the NRA and the gun lobbying companies is around that sort of message. So,
and you kind of become part of a tribe in a way, and absolutely. You resist in a way. It's a little bit like, say, you were saying the Collingwood Football Club. It's a little bit like, because you are so fortress, you have this fortress mentality, you actually, everybody else is an outsider. It's that in-group, out-group kind of social identity thing.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting and taps into some of the work that I do. But it's this idea that, you know, there's a lot of emphasis in marketing and just in the world about in-groups, right, and forming identities and alignments. But a huge thing that often gets overlooked is how important the out-group is, and right, distancing yourself. If everyone agrees, right, then there's no in-group. And so one of, just an example, I remember, so Nike a few years or a few months ago had this campaign where they had Colin Kaepernick, and you know, right, and so he had been a polarizing feature. And when they did that, a lot of people got really, really upset and started burning their stuff. And you know, the general sentiment was like, this was negative, and their stock dropped. And I remember, and I looked at it, and I was like, this is a good time to buy Nike, because what I expected to happen was people would see this outrage and be like, well, I don't want to be like them. I'm going to, you know, buy Nike as a result. And that's actually exactly what happened. And so I did put my money where my mouth was, and so it worked out decently there. But the idea there is that, you know, the ad itself didn't really, I don't know if it would have done much, but what did do a lot was a lot of people freaking out and getting really upset, and so you had this dissociative outgroup. So the same thing with the gun lobby, I imagine, is that, you know, if people were just like, oh, okay, people have guns, that's fine, then you wouldn't have this, you know, this victim sort of identity, this victim complex, you know, positioning yourself
away. It really kind of strengthens your bond.
Exactly.
By saying, all these people are out to get me and take my gun away.
Exactly.
But what I find interesting is it the product itself that becomes the reason why you have this in-group, out-group kind of mentality? Does the product have to be something that's extreme? Because even the Colin Kaepernick thing, it was this extreme political view, you know, like describe the Colin Kaepernick, what he did.
Oh, so Colin Kaepernick was a NFL quarterback, and as a protest for police brutality, he decided to take a knee during the national anthems. And as a result, because
Trump tweeted. And
yeah, people generally interpreted it as not necessarily just a protest against police brutality, but also just a protest against America in general. Mm-hmm. And so people got very upset at him, and he actually hasn't been signed on and hasn't played for the last couple of years as well. So he became this polarizing feature, polarizing person. And as a result, Nike ran an ad kind of looking at people who were, you know, handicapped and down and out, and Colin Kaepernick was one of the main features. And as a result, you had the people who generally thought, you know, he was bad, being upset that they used him. And
but it's that base thing. It's that thing, say, with One Nation, which is that if you appeal to your base, it actually strengthens that. Whether that brings in more people, I think, is the critical issue. Whether it even more dramatically separates the in-group and the out-group. Is that what happens? Is it hard then to join the in-group if you're part of the out-group? Do we know? We're not sure. So in terms of the gun kind of thing, like how hard is it for a person who is an outsider to become part of the gun community? Is it really literally you just have to buy a gun and then you become part of the community? And then do you have to kind of give over to the values, meanings, whatever that is? When I think about, say, there could be, I guess, what do we call it, amateur or social shooters who don't want to be part of that community. But the moment that you buy a gun, do you, by default, become part of that in-group and the out-group becomes a scary one? Because, I don't know, are there some low-key, not hardcore Collingwood supporters out there, or have I got it completely wrong?
It's a very good question, Paul. And sometimes it's just your family's history. So normally new shooters are the sons or the daughters of previous shooters. Sometimes it comes from need. So a lot of farmers just buy guns for pest control, etc.
Yeah.
So it's just part of the life.
Which is where the argument often comes in. It's not, I'm not doing it to be a leisure gun person, a leisure shooter. What do they call it? A recreational shooter. They do it because they're farmers. That's why you need an AK-47 to get rid of lots of rabbits. But do you really? I don't know.
No, and I should also say this, Paul, that there's a lot of, I'm not sure if the terminology is correct, but positive shooting. And what I mean is clay target shooting, for example, is a sport. It's an Olympic sport.
Mm.
And Australia has incredible tradition with several gold Olympic medals that are actually from
that. But people don't equate that. When they think about the NRA, and I don't know what the Australian version of the NRA is, they see that as a different concept. And again, maybe that's the in-group, out-group thing as well, is that they see that as, well, that's separate to these people who buy guns.
I very much agree. If you are outside that group, you normally associate guns with hunting and you know,
killing stuff. Not killing clay.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so my guess would be that, say, farmers who might have that separate group where they have to, you know, protect their livestock and whatnot, probably don't have as, you know, a strong gun identity with the rest of their group because they probably don't get attacked in the same sort of way. People might be more supportive of, oh, okay, we understand why you would want a gun, right, to protect, you know, from
other animals. You would find, Jeff, that a lot of farmers, though, are hunters as well because they live in areas where, for example, deer hunting is very, very popular in the state of Victoria. You'll find that a lot of farmers that live in country Victoria would have a small 22 caliber gun for pest control and have a higher caliber gun for deer hunting, which is perfectly legal and et cetera, et cetera. But it's a bit of a difficult question to answer to, in that some people just have guns purely for pest control and that's it. Some others really love being part of that community and take it to sort of that next level.
It's a bit like belonging to, I don't know, the Wagner opera community, really. Like, you're an outsider who would go to an opera for 18 hours kind of thing. You actually do have to kind of engage yourself in it, and a lot of people who aren't in the community don't understand it completely. I mean, I'm still, you know, afraid of guns, and I'm not part of the... I'm very much part of the gelato community, but not part of the gun community. I'm also part of the burger community as well, and I think one of the really interesting things in that community is the emergence of the vegan burger at Grilled. And I don't know, are either of you vegans?
No.
You're both
no, but
lovers of carne?
I'm a moral hypocrite because I think it's the right thing to do, but I do.
Have you tried the? Have you tried any of the kind of new vegan offerings around Melbourne? Because, you know, like, how long have you lived in Melbourne, Jeff?
A little over a year now.
Yeah. Have you been to any of the vegan places?
I have not.
You have not. I'll take you to Cornish Arms sometime.
All right.
And we'll try it. We can all go to Cornish Arms and we'll do a podcast from Cornish Arms. Do you? I'm assuming you're Italian. Vegan is a dirty word. Really?
It is. And if I may say, Paul, I do a lot of work across the Middle East, and I really struggle when I spend 3 or more weeks there because I don't have access to pork, which is a very difficult thing for me. I eat a lot of pork. I come from a region in Italy where the cuisine is very much based on pork. And
is that from the north?
From the north.
So yeah, is pork a big part of that, is
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely.
And so you miss it when you go to the Middle East. And you actually... Wow, that's amazing.
Very much. So they, I spend a lot of my time when I go there in Saudi Arabia, and they have turkey bacon and chicken sausages.
That's true,
and
yes.
Look, they don't quite taste like a pork sausage as much as one would like to think about it. And I really, really struggle. The region where I come from, there's a lot of cured meats that are based on pork. One particular section of the pork that I like is the neck. And anyway,
very specific.
But really, it is a struggle for me more than anything else. Like, I don't drink a lot of alcohol, so when I'm there and I don't have access to alcohol, that's
doesn't
fine.
Doesn't matter, yeah.
But pork, yeah.
So you're from Milan?
I was born in Milan and grew up in Parma, which is
where all the food is.
Yes.
Wow.
The Parmesan cheese and the prosciutto. So again, pork. Yes. That's where I went to university. So,
right. Yeah. Okay. And so you're doing a lot of work in the Middle East, and you were talking about how, you know, the whole idea of culture is different as well, both but the food particularly, but also just the kind of people's expectations of, you know, how service should be and things like that.
Absolutely. So Saudi Arabia in particular, we often say Middle East, but a place like Dubai is fairly different to Riyadh. Dubai is fairly open,
right.
Non-conservative. Saudi Arabia is one of the most fascinating places I go to, but very, very conservative. So, for example, it is a very segregated society.
Mm.
So you go to a restaurant and there's a male entrance and a family entrance.
Family.
Exactly.
And so do the males go through the family entrance as well?
Correct, with their family. Females are not allowed to go there by themselves.
Own.
Correct.
Mm.
All the interactions you would normally have with a male. It's very strange because even when talking to a student, a female student, I know that I shouldn't shake her hand, and also that I shouldn't always look at her. They normally come with their husband or older brother. And so when I do recruitment in Southeast Asia, I don't have to think about all these things. I just talk to the student, shake their hand, and that's it. In Saudi Arabia, I need to be conscious about all these things and who I look at and how. And
so
how
you're selling education.
Correct, yes.
And so... That's a really interesting concept as well, selling education in a market where, as you say, the women aren't necessary. I mean, are women allowed to get education in Saudi Arabia? I'm not making any assumptions here. I'm just asking a question.
They are, Paul, but they need permission, which is
right.
Part of the problem. Women in Saudi Arabia, they need permission for pretty much everything, from finding a job to opening a bank account to starting overseas.
So when you go to Saudi Arabia, for example, for student recruitment, do you develop different campaigns for, say, Saudi Arabia than from, say, if you're going to, I don't know, the UAE or somewhere like that? Are they different ways that you pitch the campaign?
Very much, Paul. And in very broad terms, one of the things that we do, obviously, we do a lot of campaigns in Arabic. We find that students relate to that much more. But we are particularly conscious around the images that we use.
Right.
So if we feature a female student in one of our university guides, for example, she would have to be fully covered. We normally show the face, but the hair should be covered. Full sleeves. We're very conscious of all those things that you wouldn't really worry about if you were to sell, you know, your degrees in a place like Vietnam or the Philippines.
But I mean, it strikes me that the Middle East, in particular, I guess, you know, I'm thinking Saudi Arabia, but also UAE and Qatar, places like that, there's a lot of money there. Why don't they have universities in those countries?
That's a million-dollar question, Paul. They do have universities, they do have schools, but their education system is not that great.
When you say not that great, is it the quality of the learning and teaching?
Absolutely. It's still very much religious-based. Right. So, and also, again, it's segregated, so you would have female universities versus male universities. I also think there's a problem in relation to what students want to study and universities offers versus what the country needs. The country needs engineers, the country needs hospitals. The population in Saudi Arabia has literally exploded in the last 10 years. They've virtually doubled. But if you go there, the workforce is mostly expats. So the Filipinos, the Pakistani, the Sri Lankans, the Indians, those are the ones that keep the country going.
Wow. Even like, so they're doing even the professional type jobs, the engineers and things are coming from other countries.
Absolutely.
So what are the locals doing?
The engineers come from America and Europe normally. Right. What are the locals doing? That's a very good question.
They're coming to other countries getting education.
Yes. They have the
largest. Would you say it's a growing market, the Middle East, or would you say it's kind of reached its peak? Are we at peak? In terms of the market availability, I guess.
It's funny you say that. We reached our peak until, you might have heard of the Saudi-Canada diplomatic spat yes. that happened yeah. last year in August. As a result of that, the Crown Prince, who's now actually is acting as king, decided that the 8,000 Saudi students based in Canada would have to return to Riyadh before being dispatched somewhere else. And every other university or university from an English-speaking country has jumped at the opportunity.
Yeah, right.
We're seeing the numbers go through the roof at the moment because of that. And it's funny because in any other country this wouldn't happen, but this was an order by the Crown Prince, so you can't really say, oh, no, sorry. Mm. They had to return.
Do many stay in their country, like stay in the country where they got their education, or do most of them go back to
Saudi Arabia? No, the majority actually like to stay.
Right, yeah. So they like the different lifestyle and things like
Absolutely.
That. Why did you come to Australia? Not that Canada's anything like Saudi Arabia, but why did you come to Australia, Jeff?
I was looking for a bit of a change,
yeah.
I guess, but not too much
change. Not too much.
Although I wanted to kind of pick your brain, actually, because you said some really interesting things there. Are you familiar at all with what's called like the gender equality paradox? Mm. No. So there's this interesting finding that's been around for the last decade or two. People have been studying it, and what they're finding is, obviously, there's going to be unequal gender representation in a lot of like STEM fields, your physics, your engineering. But what you would expect, right, is the more gender equal societies become, your Swedens, your Finlands, maybe even your Australias and your Canadas, the more equal those will become, right, those fields will become. But what they actually are finding is the opposite. The more gender equal a society, the more polarized these fields are. So you actually find the lowest rates of, you know, female engineers and physics people in the more equal societies and the more less equal size, the more engineers and you get in the for who are females. And both two things you said there that I thought were really interesting was, one, the permission aspect, right? So if you're asking permission to go to school, it's going to be hard to get, you know, permission to go study arts and psychology and philosophy, right? But if you wanted to go study engineering, okay, that might be more acceptable. And same thing with the demand, right? Is that if it's, you know, they need more engineers and that's what the society is pushing for, right? You can get a bit more of that. I don't know.
But so with that paradox issue, is it that the people are of particular gender are naturally drawn towards it because of their biology, or naturally or drawn towards
so,
it
so this
because
is, this
of
is
the
why
norms.
It's a bit of a paradox ish, or at least
because so, I think one of the difficulties you have is you can't separate gender from sex as well, like gender being, you know, how society imposes how people of a particular sex behave.
So a lot of people look at those findings and use it as a strong evidence for gender essentialism or sex essentialism.
Right. Yes.
Right, saying, oh, well, see,
women should be doing blah.
Right. So it's obvious if, you know, women can do whatever they want and they're choosing this, and that means that's what, you know.
This is really interesting because I think this is when these kinds of studies become quite political as well, is that you push up against the kind of political, cultural elements of these issues, is that we have evidence of this thing, but what does it tell us?
Exactly. And then you get, you know, so if you're finding less women in tech, you can say, well, it's not that there's systemic discrimination. It's more that women just preferred not to go into tech, and here's some studies that show that. And like I said, there's alternative explanations for why you might get this gender equality paradox, some of which you just sort of kind of alluded to.
And when recruiting students, Jeff, it's so funny you say that. We see that the males tend to go into engineering and IT, the females tend to go into, you know, the arts and the psychology degrees. But across the world, we're seeing a bit of a change. More and more girls are going into engineering and IT, but not in Saudi. The typical male student will still go for engineering and IT, so the cohort is heavily skewed towards the sort of the technical degrees, whereas the women tend to choose the arts or humanity degrees.
But I think this is the question of what is choosing. You know, I think it's really hard to get your head around the concept of choice when you are a product of the culture that you live in, of the history of your culture. You know, like people could say, I don't know, Indigenous people choose to be poor, but they don't, you know. But we could look at it and you could say, well, you know, the most kind of disadvantaged group in Australia are Indigenous people. That's what the evidence tells us. Therefore, they're drawn towards being disadvantaged. Of course they're not, you know, that there is a whole history there that leads to that. And I think that's the difficulty in, you know, maybe in terms of the concept of choice, me doing air quotes here, choice in Saudi Arabia or in Australia or Canada or anything, it's an incredibly complex kind of area. And I think gender is a really interesting one, and we don't want to get in because none of us are gender or sexuality researchers or anything like that. But I do want to kind of finish and talk a little bit about Brand AFL and the fact that this weekend is the AFLW or the AFL grand final, because I don't know why we have to put the W at the end. It's still the Australian Football League. We don't call it AFLM. So it's the AFL grand final on the weekend, and yet the AFL has completely misread the room and focused very much on the men's competition. Any thoughts about how they've kind of completely missed the opportunity to create a whole new brand with the AFLW, I'll call it, when in fact it's got a real kind of following? I guess you'd call it grassroots, a little bit like the kind of vegan following, but it's a real opportunity, I would have thought.
I couldn't agree more. And while I don't have the answer to that, Paul, I think 50% of the fan base is actually female. So
or the 50% is potential fan base.
Yes,
I think.
But AFL strikes me as a family sport. So I'm a rugby ex-player and fan, and it's not a game where, like, my wife likes AFL, but she doesn't really like rugby. It's easier to sell, I think, AFL to that part, to the female public, than it is other sports. So, as you said, they completely misread the room. But yeah, I'm not really sure why.
Yeah. It's funny, I often think, and this is, you know, I guess the marketing part of me, which is if you're going to try something new, you try it, particularly with something like this, you try it boots and all, you go hard into it and really see how it goes. And I think there's been this softly approach, which has really, you know, made a lot of people a bit uncomfortable about the way that the Australian Football League's introduced this women's competition. And particularly, you know, when you see the enthusiasm from other women, and then you have so much promotion about young girls kind of saying, finally, I can see role models. And it's funny that three men here talking. But as an example, you know, like it's that thing of, you know, when you see women taking, and we talked about this at the last podcast, when you see women taking kind of the major roles in films, the first argument that comes back from a lot of men, which is, well, I can't see myself reflected in that film. And you think, well, what about women for the entire history of life, of society, that they don't see themselves? And I think it was really interesting that, you know, the AFL is run predominantly by men, that they can't see that. They can't see that they are missing out, at a marketing perspective, an opportunity, but also missing out on being good kind of citizens by saying, of course there should be a women's competition. And this does come back to that conversation about the gender equality paradox, which is there not a lot of people, not a lot of women playing AFL because women don't like playing football, or is it because the opportunities aren't there and there's no history or heritage of it? Could it be?
It's a tough question, and it also begs another question, which is, you're saying, you know, AFL should go all in and see what happens. But let's say they did, and it didn't really, you know, capture the market. What is the responsibility of marketers and of business to sort of be the change they want to see in the world if the market is not receptive to it?
Well, I think that's, for me, that comes down to this whole idea that the market is often so hard to predict that sometimes you do need to just, you know, commit at a moral level. And I think, I mean, we're going to have to wrap it up, but, you know, I think, again, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand could have come out and had a very conservative response, but she didn't. She said, I'm doing what I think is the right thing to do. And I think that certainly paid off for her. And maybe we don't want to get into that just at the end of the show, because there's a lot to talk about there, but maybe another time.
Stay tuned for next time.
That's right. I'll get everybody back in and we'll see if we can get Jacinda in to kind of talk about it as well. But we should finish it there because we've gone well over time. Thank you, Jeff Rotman, for joining us. And thank you, Luca Cella, for joining us. And hopefully you've enjoyed listening to This.